This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we're going to talk about the structure of dark matter and how we're going to get the very first picture of a black hole. That's going to be something. But first, you've probably heard the story of the lost city of Atlantis, the ancient Greek city that was swept into the sea overnight. Atlantis, of course, was just a story created by Plato, but that doesn't stop people from searching. Scuba divers stumbled, or I guess they rather swam across what they thought looked like submerged ancient cities off of Greece. Maybe is Atlantis the city? It turned out to be something quite different. Rachel Feltman is here to uncover that story and other selected short subjects in science. She's editor of the Speaking of Science blog for the Washington Post. Always good to see you, Rachel.
Great to see you too, Ira.
What does this city, so to speak, look like?
So you can't blame the snorkelers who found it for thinking it was a lost city. It really does look like one. They're what look like cobblestone streets and these interesting pillars and these very symmetrical kind of fountain-like structures. But researchers knew as soon as they went down there that it probably wasn't man-made because they couldn't find the pottery or coins you'd expect from an ancient Greek plaza. And they analyzed the makeup of these structures, and they found that they've actually been made by bacteria and were probably made around 5 million years ago, so way before humans were around to build cities. Basically, when bacteria start to feed off of methane vents in the ocean, they excrete this calcium that then combines with the methane to form a cement-like substance called dolomite. And because the bacteria are crowding around in this very symmetrical way, they'll form these super symmetrical structures of dolomite around jets of methane, or if there's kind of a spread out, ooze of methane gas, they'll make these things that look like cobblestone. And these structures are pretty common in the ocean, but usually found deeper because that's where we tend to see methane leaks today. Mm-hmm. So, snorkelers aren't used to finding these so close to the coast, but they're actually a pretty common phenomenon.
So it's sort of it's cement poop.
it's basically bacteria poop. Really beautiful bacteria poop.
Well, how long does it take the bacteria to sort of build this kingdom? How old are they, these structures? Do we know?
We don't know how many years it took for them to build up, but I would say it would probably take some time. But they are, these particular ones, they think are between 2 to 5 million years old.
Wow. And so it's common. They're found everywhere. And
yeah.
Usually in deeper water.
Right. Where the methane leaks are. There is no methane in this area off the coast of the Greek Isles right now, but there must have been at some time.
That's good news for those who want to keep looking for the lost city. Let's talk about new evidence for the origin of our hobbit cousins, the Homo floresiensis. Mm-hmm. I think I got that right.
Yeah. So the Indonesian island of Flores is home to these early humans that are often referred to as hobbits because they were just 3.5 feet tall, which is the same stature as human relatives that were living some 2 million years ago. But these guys, the hobbits, lived just a few tens of thousands of years ago. So they caused a lot of controversy when they were first discovered. Some people thought that they were children or individuals with congenital abnormalities. But lately, researchers have been pretty confident that these are indeed their own human species and that they did indeed live just a few tens of thousands of years ago. And now they found some really exciting evidence that might help point us towards their origins. They found some 700,000-year-old fossils that are more similar to Homo erectus. They're more what we would expect for an early human from that period.
And not some branch that developed on its own, like the other theory said.
Right. So they know that human relatives lived on this island starting around 1 million years ago at least, because there are tools that old. Mm-hmm. So what they think is that these humans similar to Homo erectus were kind of washed onto this island during a storm, and there is some like historical precedence for that, just groups of people getting, waterlogged, thrown onto an isolated island. And then they started to evolve in this isolated area and experienced island dwarfism, where because resources are scarce, to be successful, a species has to get smaller and smaller. The cool thing is that these 700,000-year-old fossils had tools with them that were significantly smaller than the 1 million-year-old tools. Mm-hmm. So it kind of creates this nice narrative of this these humans getting washed up on this island, progressively getting smaller and smaller, and eventually a few tens of thousands of years ago being the hobbits that we think probably went extinct after interacting with modern humans when they showed up on the island.
Mm-hmm. You know, just when you think you have human evolution figured out, another piece of evidence comes in. And
it's a very complicated family tree.
It is. And finally, a fish. Now, this is a fish that has learned, this is amazing, learned how to spit at the human face.
Well, archer fish could already spit at human faces if they wanted to. Uh-huh. They're considered some of the only fish to use tools because they use these high-powered jets of spit to hit prey like insects. And you can train them to spit at particular objects. But what's really exciting is that researchers taught them to recognize individual human faces and spit at those faces as opposed to some 40 other human faces. And this is very uncommon. A few animals have been shown to recognize human faces, but most of that work has been on birds that actually share the same brain structure that humans are thought to use for facial recognition. And then some domesticated animals where, you know, it would make sense for them to have gotten better at recognizing humans. And bees are the wild card. Nobody really knows why bees can be trained to recognize human faces. But now we add archer fish to that group.
Have an idea how they trained them to do this? Was it like Pavlovian? You know, you see,
well, yeah, they
get rewards.
Apparently it's as easy as training a dog. You just give them food pellets when they spit at the right thing. And, you know, we already knew that they could be trained to spit at random objects like colors and shapes. But now we know that you can do the same with human faces. And human faces are thought to be a particularly complicated object to recognize for most animals that aren't human. So it kind of indicates that maybe this skill isn't as difficult to come across in the animal kingdom as we think.
Now we need one of those shoot at the clown contest between the fish.
Yeah, that would be pretty good.
You know, who can fill up the little clown face at the circus? When you go to the arcades and you have to shoot the water gun at the clown.
I'm sure someone is working on that study.
Sure. All right, Rachel, thank you. Thanks again for such wonderful stuff.
Thanks,
Rachel Feldman
me.
Is editor of Speaking of Science blog for the Washington Post. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Now, if you saw the movie Contact, you might remember that the telescope that is a backdrop for much of the beginning of the story, the big white dish set in the crater in the jungle, that's the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico, the world's largest radio telescope. And it has a rich history of real science, playing a role in the SETI project, the hunt for neutron stars, near-Earth asteroids, Nobel-winning research on pulsars, and more. But now, the National Science Foundation, the NSF, is questioning whether to continue funding it at all. My next guest explains why, breaks down the potential consequences of shutting down Arecibo. Nadia Drake is a science journalist for National Geographic. You can read her story on the National Geographic blog, No Place Like Home. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Give us a good thing, if you can call it, about shutting down Arecibo.
Well, fundamentally, the problem is that NSF doesn't have enough money to fund all the science it wants to. So if it can pull money from Arecibo, it might be able to give that to something else. But that is really about it. The trouble is that NSF's budget is basically flatlined, and the agency needs to figure out where to spend its limited resources. So to do that, NSF relies on the input and recommendations of external review panels and committees, many of which have, over the last decade, suggested reducing funding for Arecibo or closing the observatory entirely.
So how much money are we talking about here?
NSF funds a little bit more than $8 million of the observatory's annual budget, which is around $12 million per year. The rest of that money comes from NASA, which is funding the work that the telescope's planetary radar does. And that work is incredibly important because that's what we're using to characterize what we call near-Earth objects, or asteroids and comets that are on potentially Earth-crossing orbits and could one day perhaps cause a very bad day on this planet.
That doesn't seem like a lot of money. It's getting, you know, some of these billionaires write out a little check every year. You know?
It is kind of like pocket change in in some schemes, yes.
It's a 50-year-old instrument. What more can it contribute to science, you know, that newer facilities cannot?
Well, there's actually two things I want to point out here. One is that Arecibo could be the next facility to directly detect gravitational waves, those ripples in the fabric of space-time that were only directly detected for the first time within the last year. Gravitational waves are produced by the most violent and energetic events in the universe, and we can use them to study things that are powerful enough to jiggle space-time, such as colliding supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies. Yeah. There's an experiment that's using Arecibo to detect gravitational waves, and it's called NanoGrav. And it's looking for waves that are produced by colliding supermassive black holes in galactic centers. And so that would be a huge deal if NanoGrav could make that detection.
Now, one of the things that you talk about in your piece is the telescope's value to Puerto Rico. I don't think people really realize that it's an important part of the Puerto Rican economy.
It is. So something like 100,000 tourists come to visit the observatory every year, and so that certainly contributes to the local economy. But aside from that, it also plays a huge role in inspiring local students to pursue careers in science and technology. So one of the programs at the observatory is called the Arecibo Observatory Space Academy, and it offers hands-on research experience to pre-college kids. Hmm. And many of the students who've come through the Space Academy were speaking at the two public meetings in Puerto Rico earlier this week about how having that experience has inspired them to continue studying science.
Wow.
And so I don't think we can in any way overstate the value of that.
Nadia, thank you very much for taking time to be
thank
with
you.
Us today. Nadia Drake is a science journalist for National Geographic. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, a bionic leaf. Yes, an artificial leaf that even does better than leaf and photosynthesis. And in fact, this leaf actually makes liquid fuel. Interesting story. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, plants have an amazing ability. Taking light from the sun, a little water from the rain, a few minerals from the soil, CO2 from the air, and turning those things into, say, a juicy tomato. Well, now researchers have found a way to combine chemistry and biology to mimic that photosynthetic process in a bionic leaf that in some measurements can beat plants at their own game, though it doesn't make tomatoes, but liquid fuel. Joining me now to talk about the bionic leaf and the intersection of biology and chemistry is Pamela Silver. She's professor of biochemistry and systems biology at Harvard Medical School and is a member of the Wyss Institute of Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard in Cambridge. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Silver.
Hello, Ira.
Let's go right to it then. Does it look like a leaf?
Everyone asks me that when journalists come to the lab. They say, can we see it? Can we look at the leaf? Unfortunately, it looks like science. It looks like a science experiment. It's a jar with a bunch of wires coming out of it.
But it's got a lot of potential, right?
Absolutely. I actually traveled with it. I took it to a commencement speech as a show and tell.
You did. There she comes again. We talked with
your little problem getting it on the plane, by the way.
Oh gosh, yes, you have to get that through security. It's a leaf. I'm telling you, it's a leaf. That's toothpaste. We talked with your collaborator Dan Nocera a few years ago about something he called an artificial leaf. Now, what's the difference between that and your bionic leaf?
So the bionic leaf actually begins with the artificial leaf, as Dan invented a process whereby. You can go directly from electricity via sunlight to electrodes that carry out what's called the water splitting reaction. And this is the key reaction in photosynthesis that generates hydrogen and oxygen. So Dan invented the artificial leaf that makes hydrogen. Now, there was a dream that hydrogen could be a fuel, and that still may come true someday, but what mm-hmm. we did was then to interface the artificial leaf with nature. And there are these really cool microbes that can eat hydrogen and fix CO2 and make stuff. So by putting the artificial leaf together with nature, we created the bionic leaf.
So you basically built something to feed the bacteria.
Dan built the artificial leaf,
right,
which provides the hydrogen. The
right.
CO2 comes from air,
right,
and everyone's happy.
Yeah. And this system can do it more efficiently than plants can?
That's right. The combination of there are problems with photosynthesis. I think it's the grand challenge is how do you make plants better? And we've done that by using this chemistry of the artificial leaf, which doesn't generate any toxins. The bacteria can grow, and they can use all the hydrogen that's being provided. So in that way, we can beat photosynthesis. We get about 10% efficiency of harvesting of light as measured by making it into stuff. And you mentioned that we make fuels. We also make plastics.
Mm-hmm. And so you're doing, well, photosynthesis is like 1% efficiency. You got 10
right.
times the output.
Right.
Of
plants
stuff.
Are about 1%. Plants are about 1%. Algae is sort of the gold standard up there at around 6%. So we're beating them all.
Wow. Does it need anything special in terms of infrastructure? In other words, do you need a pipe to pipe in concentrated CO2, or just sitting out there on your lab bench?
Well, it's more or less just sitting in my lab. It's special. We had to build it. Dan makes these awesome electrodes that can provide the hydrogen. They sit down in a jar. The jar has to be sterile so you don't get contamination. And we do pipe in CO2, but it actually will do it with air as well.
Oh.
We don't necessarily have to provide CO2. I don't know. It doesn't look super impressive, but it's really performing well.
All right, well, let's talk about the practicalities. Then how do you scale it up, or what kind of engineering
right.
do you need to do?
Well, so in the laboratory, it's small. It works at about 100 milliliters. In fact, I got a really cute letter from a seventh grader asking if they could build their own bionic leaf, and it occurred to me that we could actually give these to schools and they could test them out. We've been able to scale it about tenfold in the laboratory, so that's pretty good. It can still sit on the lab bench. That's a liter. Going beyond that is really a job for chemical engineers. And the good news here is that it is not composed of particularly expensive materials, and the materials are not rare.
Mm. You know, you talked about using engineered bacteria to make a fuel, and you said plastics also. Can you make other stuff? The bacteria make
sure, that's
stuff?
The beauty of, that for me is the beauty of the system. And the thing I'm excited about is that, in fact, biology is the best chemistry. It can do things that chemists in the laboratory can't do. And we call this synthetic biology. You've talked about this on the show before. The ability to engineer organisms to do this chemistry to make, in essence, almost anything that's, for example, carbon-based. And that's our dream, is what can we make with these different organisms, and what kinds of organisms can we interface with the leaf?
So what you're basically doing is equipping these bacteria with which can make whatever you'd like to engineer them to do with a source of food, basically,
the
leaf.
And it's important to remember that this does not compete with land, because the bacteria, they can sit there in my laboratory and they can get fed the energy, the electricity from a solar panel sitting on the roof. So it's really a modular system. The two can be separated.
Mm-hmm. So where do you go from here now with this?
As I said, personally, I want to expand the system in its diversity of what it can make. There's further optimization that can be done to make it so that it's more compatible with different conditions in the water. Increasing the output of hydrogen. This is Dan's side of the project, and we're very interested more in optimizing the biology and increasing that diversity at the biological end.
And do you have to genetically modify the bacteria to make what you'd like it to make?
Sure. The bacteria are highly programmed,
yeah.
although in the case of plastics,
yeah.
the particular bacteria that we use, it's called Ralstonia. It's a soil bacteria. It's actually an industrial organism already because it makes a plastic precursor called PHB. And companies already use this as one of the major sources of this plastic precursor to make biodegradable plastics. So it does that naturally. However, we can engineer it further, and in this case, we engineered it to make alcohols that can be burned as fuels. But as I said, the ability to engineer biology is amazing now. And so we can start to think about making higher value commodities, have it make food to feed other organisms. We're preparing a NASA grant now where we think we might be able to use it in space. So this is what we're thinking.
Wow, that sounds terrific. Wow. It is kind of like, where can I get one of my own to have fun with it?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about a DIY experiment thing where we gave them to people.
I think, maybe there is some sort of, Kickstarter thing.
Sure.
Well, if you're taking CO2 out of the atmosphere and you're making fuel out of it, are you taking more out of the atmosphere than you're putting back in when you use the fuel?
This is the whole premise around biofuels, is that they're carbon neutral, that you recover CO2, you make it into stuff if it's fuel, and then you burn it. So the equation around CO2 remains neutral.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have you back when you make some more headway.
And
you
have, we will.
And you have one I can make myself here.
There's another story coming soon.
Oh, is there? Can you give us a little hint? Come on. No one's listening. Just you and me.
Just thinking about plants.
Okay.
Real plants.
Is there a science fiction movie? This won't grow out of the beaker or somewhere in your desk and take over.
That's the thing. It's not growing. The bacteria are growing, but needs this special electrode in order to promote growth. I think what I have to do is make one that looks like a leaf to satisfy all you.
Absolutely.
You'll
get
we'll
those TV
that.
Cameras in there so fast.
Absolutely.
All right. Dr. Silver, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Pamela Silver is a professor of biochemistry and systems biology at Harvard Medical School and is member of the Wyss Institute of Biologically Inspired Engineering. Kind of think of our show like that at Harvard in Cambridge. This summer, I hope you all get a chance to get out of town to go stargazing, one of my favorite things. Get the old telescope out and stare and wonder at those millions of silent worlds out there so far away. But as you look up at all that stuff, the planets, the stars, the streaks of the Milky Way, keep in mind that everything we see, including every single element in the periodic table, and yes, that includes us, everything we see makes up, just about 4% of the total matter and energy in the universe, 4%. The other 96, it's dark to us, dark matter, dark energy, dark because, one, we can't see it, and as my next guest says, when astronomers don't understand something, they just add dark to it. But she is trying to shed some light on that mysterious dark matter by mapping it. How it's spread around the universe? Is it smooth and streaky, clumpy and bunched together, or thin and wispy like spider webs? As you can imagine, you gotta get a little creative to map something you can't see. And one of the things she writes about in her new book, Mapping the Heavens, is how to do that. Priyamvada Natarajan is a theoretical physicist and professor in the departments of physics and astronomy at Yale University, author of Mapping the Heavens, the Radical Scientific Ideas That Reveal the Cosmos. Welcome to Science Friday.
Delighted to be here, Ira.
How do you map something we can't even see, like the dark matter?
So we exploit the bending of light that mass generates. And so what is done is use this effect called gravitational lensing, which is predicted by Einstein's theory of general relativity. So if you have distant galaxies whose light is propagating towards us, and along the way you encounter a clump of dark matter that causes deflections and therefore distortions in the shapes of galaxies. And because dark matter is smeared everywhere in the universe, but quite lightly in most places, and it's clumped in rare locations, by looking at regions where there is very little distortion or no distortion, we know what the shape distributions of galaxies are on average, statistically. So then when we look through these regions where there's a lot of distortion compared to what is the norm, we can back out the distribution of matter, which is mostly unseen, mm-hmm. that is causing these deviations in shapes. So essentially what happens is a galaxy, instead of looking somewhat, if you start out with circular galaxies, would get stretched out and they would look like little ellipses. And they could be quite dramatically stretched out if there's a lot of dark matter along the line of sight to us.
What does the map tell you? I mean, what can we learn from mapping about the true nature of dark matter?
So some of the regions where there's a lot of dark matter are called clusters of galaxies. So these are the largest repositories of dark matter. Mm-hmm. And since with data from the Hubble Space Telescope, where we get these very exquisite images, you can actually map in the granularity of dark matter, so how it's clumped. And there's information in the clumping of dark matter on what its potential nature might be. So for example, if dark matter is what we believe it to be, these cold, collisionless particles, probably created at some point in the early universe, then they tend to clump on all scales. So you should see a whole range, a hierarchy of clumps, some large ones, some small ones, with no real end. I mean, there's no cutoff. You see all kinds of clumps. Whereas if dark matter was a warm dark matter particle, something that was moving much faster in the from the early universe formed then there's sort of a scale beyond which there would be no clumps. It would be a lot smoother, the distribution. So the goal, since we haven't detected the dark matter particle directly yet, we're really looking for indirect clues on what it might be. And I think that's what gravitational lensing can provide.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Priyamvada Natarajan, author of Mapping the Heavens, the Radical Scientific Ideas That Reveal the Cosmos, on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Let's talk more about it. You write in your book that you first got interested in this stuff by mapping the night sky over Delhi using a Commodore 64. I had one of those. It couldn't have been easy. Tell us about that.
That's right. So it actually dates me, doesn't it? So I did have
I'm
a
in that
Commodore
boat even worse than you are, but go ahead.
Right. So I had this computer, and I was itching to do something. I learned programming on my own, and I went to the director of the Nehru Planetarium, and I asked for a project to do. So she mushed me off and said, okay, you have a computer. Why don't you map the night sky and which planets and constellations you'd be able to see above the night sky at Delhi? So I went off, and I did it. It took me, you know, a good part of 6 to 8 weeks. And then I went back, and she said, she thought she'd gotten rid of me because this pesky little kid, right? And so then she said, okay, I said, I've done it. So I showed her the map. And she sort of said, well, you know, you live in Delhi now, but maybe you live in Boston or Brisbane. What about the night sky? So I said, oh, I've done that already. You just have to put in the latitude and longitude of any place on Earth, and I can pull up the star map. So at that point, finally, she sort of took me seriously and then gave me a little research project. And, you know, before that, I had actually looked through a telescope, and I fell in love anyway with the cosmos. So that sort of really got me started. So on this sort of real love affair with astrophysics.
So how did you follow that up to become an astrophysicist?
Well, I was really fortunate. I got a full scholarship to come to college at MIT. So I did my undergraduate there. And I had some fabulous professors, great courses. And then I went on after a slight detour because I'm interested in the history of ideas. So yeah. I did some graduate work in history and philosophy of science, also at MIT. Then I went to Cambridge, England for my PhD. And I had the great fortune of working with sort of one of the greatest living cosmologists, Martin Rees. Did my thesis there, was a member of Trinity College and a fellow there. And then I got a job at Yale, and I've been there since.
You mentioned about studying philosophy. Do you need to be philosophical? Have a little bent there to work on this kind of stuff you can't see?
Well, I don't know about the philosophical. I mean, human beings by nature have always been intrigued by the invisible, right?
Yeah.
And I think the philosophical angle helps to sort of keep everything in perspective. Because, you know, in a way, what I find it much more comfortable to deal with these sort of cosmic scales, you know, talk about 3.5 billion years, a process taking 100 million years, all of that is somehow much more comprehensible to me than, you know, day-to-day life stuff. So I think being philosophical has been very helpful.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk lots more with Priyamvada Natarajan, author of Mapping the Heavens. Stay with us. We'll talk about more dark energy, dark matter, the dark side of the universe, all coming up after the break. We'll take your calls. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, 844-724-8255. Tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about mapping the universe's web of dark matter with Priya Natarajan. She's a theoretical astrophysicist and professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Yale and author of Mapping the Heavens. Really good big book to read. I'd like to bring on another astronomer who's also studying something notoriously hard to see, and that is a black hole. And he has a plan for snapping a close-up of it. He wants to use a telescope as big as the Earth. No big deal. Shep Doleman is director of the Event Horizon Telescope Project. He's also an astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Massachusetts. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ara.
So what's so hard about looking at a black hole that you need a telescope as big as the Earth to take a picture of?
Right. So first of all, black holes are by definition something you can't see. I like to imagine it as trying to take a picture of a dinosaur. We know dinosaurs exist. We see their footprints in clay. We see their bones, but no one's ever seen one. And it's the same with black holes. As Priya was saying, you can see light bend around them, but you can't see them themselves. So you have to find a way to build a telescope that has about 2,000 times the magnifying power of the Hubble Space Telescope, because these are the smallest things in the heavens that are predicted by Einstein's theory of general relativity.
You know, it's kind of weird because we tend to think of black holes as these massive objects swallowing up everything around them, when in reality, you're saying that they're relatively small.
They are the tiniest things you can imagine. They are the end result of gravity going haywire and collapsing a bunch of matter into a point source. But around that point is this wonderful membrane called the event horizon. And that's the point where the gravity is so intense that even light can't escape. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So all this gas and dust around the black hole is madly trying to get into a very small volume. And in a cosmic traffic jam, it heats up to billions of degrees. So black holes can be some of the brightest things that we see in the sky.
You know, in the film Interstellar, they used some equations by physicists to create what they thought was a real picture of a black hole. How close, you know, do you think they got to it?
So they got really close. I mean, no one's ever seen one, of course, but that is as close, I think, as we're going to get. It turns out, speaking of Commodore 64s that Priya was, there was someone in 1979 that made a wonderful illustration of what a black hole might look like using, you know, primitive computers. And it looks very much like what the computer graphics designers did for the movie Interstellar. And that's the kind of thing that we humbly hope to do with the Event Horizon Telescope.
Can you see black hole if you take a picture of it? Is that what it's going to look like, a hole in space?
So a black hole is surrounded by this, if you think of it as a three-dimensional flashlight of hot gas that's radiating light all around the black hole. So what you wind up seeing is what's called the shadow of the black hole. Light that normally would leave the black hole on the other side of the black hole gets bent around in a U-turn towards you, so you wind up seeing a ring of light around a relatively dim interior, and that's called the shadow. And that's what we are trying to measure and image with the Event Horizon Telescope.
Priya, what would you want to know from this very first picture of a black hole? What would you most interest you to see?
Well, I think the shape of the shadow is a very important test of the predictions of general relativity, and really of physics in the strong gravitational regime. So the effects that we expect theoretically on light and light bending by black holes, this would be sort of one very important test at very sort of high resolution, small scale test. Sort of a slightly more compelling test than I would say than the bending that we see by larger, more massive objects, because black holes are so compact. The clusters of galaxies that I was talking to you about are huge things on the sky, and they have a huge amount of matter. So the deflections that they generate, the matter generates, they are in consonance with Einstein's theory. The question is, when you have something that's really that compact, how well does the theory still work, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's no reason to believe that there's any problem with the theory at the moment. But, you know, who knows what the Event Horizon Telescope could tell us.
You know, what's interesting, you say who knows, one of the hottest topics about black holes in these last few decades has been a discussion started by Stephen Hawking and other people about what happens to the stuff that falls into the black hole. What happens to the information that's contained in all of that? Can you give us an idea what that debate is all about?
So I think actually Stephen Hawking has a beautiful analogy. So one of the problems is that, as Shep mentioned, the event horizon is really seen as this point of no return. Because once you pass the event horizon, which encases the singularity, and the singularity is the place where all the known physical laws that we know about and understand break down. So what really happens to information, to matter, when it crosses the event horizon is not very well understood, and we don't even have a framework. But Hawking had this interesting suggestion, and they're working on it with Andrew Strominger and Malcolm Perry at Harvard and Cambridge, which is, suppose you had an encyclopedia that was encased in a glass case, tight case, right? Mm-hmm. And you want to look up the capital of Rwanda. So you just go there, you look it up, you know, look at the page. Now you burn the encyclopedia, and all the ashes of the encyclopedia are still in that box. Nothing's left that box, right? It's right in there. So theoretically speaking, the information on the capital of Rwanda is still in there. It's just that you don't know how to access it and how to extract it anymore. And I think that these are sort of the ways in which they're starting to think about sort of analogies for the event horizon to develop a quantum mechanical understanding, because that's sort of what seems to be lacking. And so sort of string theory seems to be providing new insights. And so that's what the buzz is about at the moment. But I love this analogy because it really drives home the point that, you know, the information is possibly there. We just don't know how to extract it. We don't have the language mathematically to describe it.
Yeah. Shep, you agree with this analogy? Is a good one?
Well, it is an interesting one, because the idea is, you know, where does the information go when it falls into the black hole? And that's why philosophers get very interested about black holes. If you talk to them about stars, they say they're beautiful. Even neutron stars, they say they're wacky. But when you talk to them about black holes, they get dreamy. And they get very interested, because this is an area of space-time that is inaccessible to us. Yeah. And that really is very, very startling and spooky. Where our whole worldview is based on Newtonian determinism, that if you know what is happening around you, you can propagate it forward in time and know where you're going to be later. But what if you're falling into a black hole and you can't tell somebody what happened to you? Is that determinism or not? Or does determinism break down? So black holes, in addition to the information theory problem, they strike at the core of Western thought.
Shep, this is an anniversary of sorts, isn't it, for the so-called Schwarzschild radius? Describe what that is.
Right. So the event horizon occurs for a non-spinning black hole at the Schwarzschild radius. And in 1915, Einstein came up with his field equations, his geometric interpretation of gravity. And it was communicated to Karl Schwarzschild, who was in the army in the trenches of World War I. And you know, unlike how I like to do my work with a cup of coffee and maybe some music, he was solving Einstein's theoretical equations in the trenches. And he came up with this solution called the point source solution, where he said, what if all the mass is concentrated into a point? He didn't think it was realistic, but he said, let's focus everything into a point. And he found that at a certain radius called the Schwarzschild radius, even light couldn't escape because the gravitational field would be too great. And he wrote this down on a postcard, mailed it to Einstein, who very famously then presented it to the Prussian Academy of Sciences in 1916. So that's the celebration and anniversary that we're looking at today.
The 100th anniversary of that.
Right. And actually, you know, Einstein actually didn't expect that there would be any exact solutions for his equations, field equations. So he was quite startled, actually. He didn't like the solution, but he was startled.
And he also did not accept black holes, as Priya said before, for many, many years.
Yeah, I mean, Einstein is this really intriguing character, right? He comes up with all these incredible radical ideas, and he is really unhappy and resists the implications of his own ideas. So this is something that I talk about in the book, and Einstein is a particularly interesting case.
Yeah, he's the father, so to speak, of, you know, all kinds of science that he didn't agree with, how it was handled once he discovered it. Especially quantum mechanics. Priya Natarajan is the author of Mapping the Heavens, also talking with Shep Doleman, director of the Event Horizon Telescope Project. We have a couple of phone calls. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Philip in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Philip.
Hi, Ira. How are you?
Hey there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
And I still have my Commodore 64 as well.
Me too.
my question is this. It seems like the scientific community has basically concluded that dark matter must exist because the equations that we have that predict gravitational lensing don't seem quite fit with the amount of matter that we're able to directly observe. And I'm just wondering what your guests think about the alternative, which might be that the equations aren't quite right.
Can I take that?
Please, Priya, go right ahead.
Yeah.
I'm not touching that one.
Okay. So actually, there's Philip, there are many independent lines of evidence that point to the existence of dark matter, not just light bending. There's the motions of stars in galaxies and galaxies and clusters, which is not commensurate with the matter that is seen, right? And so Einstein's equations actually predict that the contents, the fate, and the geometry of the universe are interlinked. And so now we have an inventory of all the matter. We also have an understanding of the geometry and the fate independently, right? And so they have to be sort of commensurate. So there's room for dark matter, although we haven't found the particle. I understand that there, it might seem that, you know, scientists have evidence, but they don't have a direct detection yet. So we're awaiting the detection of a particle, right? But I think what is, and this is not like ether, probably you're wondering whether this is going to go away. The only alternative that has been suggested, and that's been worked on quite a lot, is sort of a modification of the equations of Newtonian dynamics. And it's called MOND, this theory. And the interesting thing is that versions of this theory can explain the motions of stars, the evidence for dark matter from galaxy scales. But this theory cannot really match up and give predictions for the light bending that is seen. So there is no real viable alternative theory at the moment. And there are independent lines of evidence that are very compelling for the existence of dark matter, although we are yet to detect the particle. But, you know, the LIGO detection, remember, it took 40 years?
Yeah.
So there are many dark matter experiments that are ongoing at the moment. And I'm actually sort of optimistic that we just might. In particular, there's one experiment called DAMA that claimed a detection more than 15 years ago, but the community was not persuaded, and only recently a replication of that experiment in five different locations on the South Pole, in Australia, South Korea, Spain, and so with a particular crystal, sodium iodide crystal as a detector. So, you know, within a couple of years, we'll know maybe that was a signal and that maybe we should take that seriously. So I'm quite excited at the possibilities.
Myra Flato, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about black holes and dark matter with Priya Natarajan, author of Mapping the Heavens, the Radical Scientific Ideas that Reveal the Cosmos, and Chip Dolleman, director of the Event Horizon Telescope Project. We have a phone call or two. Let's go to the phones. Let me take a tweet first, because you touched on this a little bit before. Martha Hussein says, is all dark matter the same? Is there anything to be inferred from the proportion of dark matter to non-dark matter?
Yes. I mean, at the moment, the simplest assumption that we're making is there's only one kind of dark matter, but there's no real reason to believe that there can't be different kinds of matter. But the dominant component appears to be cold that is moving very slowly and practically collisionless. You know, for all you know, one of my favorite candidates is all my unmatched socks. Every time I do laundry, I miss socks. So, you know, that could be a component of dark matter.
The greatest unsolved mystery of science. Where do the socks go in the laundry?
That's right.
Absolutely. Shep, how will we know if we see something truly shocking and you take this image of the black hole, there's something really shocking that the image itself is correct, right? You're expecting something? Are you ready to upset 100 years of black hole theory for what you see?
Well, as I like to say, it's never a good idea to bet against Einstein. But even he, I think, would be really marvelously excited by what we're about to do. So the idea is that you should see this ring of light around the black hole, and the size and shape of that was predicted by Einstein. If we see some deviations from that, if it doesn't look round, if it's not as large or it's smaller than we think it should be, that would be an indication that either we're not looking at a black hole, it could be something weird and exotic, like a boson star or something that would be very difficult to think about how we could even construct it, but it's potentially possible. Or it would be as Priya was discussing, a change in general relativity, a change in Einstein's equations. So what we're looking for is this ring of light, and if it's the right size, let's say around the 4 million solar mass black hole at the center of our galaxy, the Milky Way, then that would tighten the noose incredibly. So in the center of our galaxy, there's this large black hole, and some wonderful groups in Germany and UCLA have seen stars orbiting around this unseen mass. And that is very powerful evidence that it's a black hole. But they only come within, let's say, 1 or 2 thousand Schwarzschild radii of this black hole. So they're very far away, and their motions are perfectly predicted by Newtonian dynamics. But we want to tighten the noose to within 1 Schwarzschild radii.
How soon will we have a photo?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question. Our global team, and this really is a global team, Ira, are getting ready to take our first potentially imaging data set in the spring of 2017. That's when we'll add sites at the South Pole, in Chile, Hawaii, Arizona, Mexico, France, and Spain. So truly an Earth-sized array to look at this exotic object.
Can't wait till it gets back from the drugstore. Thank you very, very much for taking time to be with us today. Sounds very exciting. Shep Doleman, director of the Event Horizon Telescope Project. He's also an astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Massachusetts. Priya Natarajan is a theoretical astrophysicist, professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Yale, author of Mapping the Heavens, the Radical Scientific Ideas That Reveal the Cosmos. A great read. It's a great wide story about the history of astronomy, and it's something that explains stuff you're always wondering about. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor. Luke Ruskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director, and Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the City University of New York. A special shout-out today to station WESA for hosting our live web stream. Thank you, Pittsburgh. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.